This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello guys, this is Clint Locklear for Trappin' Radio. We're going to get into a little bit of Renaissance redneck way of thinking, or not thinking. Whichever one you think it is, that's fine with me. But it's kind of a life's a weird thing that's kind of got this show going to where it's going. Now, I did a rant yesterday, which is called Rant of a Free Trapper, here on Trappin' Radio, about choose. You know, basically making a choice or not making a choice, and those choices put you exactly where you're supposed to be in the universe because you decided to be there, where it was conscious or unconscious. And that was a little rant that I did. And then Chip emailed me last night, and apparently that just like tripped his trigger, and he was just saying, you need to expand on that more. And I didn't really know how, because I didn't want to repeat what I did last night on the rant. And then before that, I got that timeline out of whack. When me and Travis got done yesterday working, something came up about reading, and I told him, you know, about, you know, it's important to try to learn to enjoy reading things that are important, because you learn a lot and stuff like that, you know. And I kind of have these father and son talks with Travis, even though he's not my son by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, just something he said triggered that for me, and we got to talking about that. And basically, his conversation boiled down to, you know, you don't know what you don't know because you only know what you do know. And since you only know what you do know, that's really not a whole lot, even though you think it really is, if you can follow that line of logic. And the reason that most successful people read and most non-successful people don't read is the non-successful never learn what they don't know, so they can't apply it or adjust to anything in life, which goes along a lot with the rant we had yesterday. And Travis brought up some people in trapping and was amazed to find out that they read. Because he's like, well, he don't look like a reader. I'm like, well, I hate to bust your bubble. He reads every day. You know, now Travis knows I read before bed. And we talked about that and this, that, and the other. And then what was so cool about this was, you know, he was talking, somehow he brought up automation. And automation, you know, is radically, has already changed the world. It's radically going to change it more. And he was saying he didn't like it. And I was asking him why. Of course, when I'm having a conversation like that, generalities don't work. So you got to be specific. He really couldn't give me anything, but he just didn't think it was right. And he kept saying that it's just not right. It's not right. It's not right. And, you know, that led us down a thing about 3D printers. Now, see, here's the interesting thing. If you don't read and you don't look for information, you don't know stuff. Now, Travis did not know that, you know, 3 years ago, people were making pistols with 3D printers at their house that could fire a live round. He didn't believe me, so I pulled it up on YouTube. He thought it was fake. I showed him another one. Then I showed him all the different ones that he could choose from. And then I showed him making pottery and this, that, and the other. And he was like, that's not right. And then, you know, that kind of led down a path of, well, what about people's jobs and this, that, and the other? Which led this really cool circle back from his thinking back to that's why it's important to read. To choose to always be learning. So once you know about stuff like this and you can make adjustments about this, and you can go listen to the other rant about that. Then came the text from Chip wanting me to expand on it. I really didn't know how. And then I'm starting a new book, and it's called Extreme Early Retirement. I thought it was written in the 70s, but it's obviously not from some of the text. Now, I haven't read the whole book. I just started it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. So that's going to be probably the majority of the show, is, and it's going to be about why. Why do you think the way that you think? And it's very applicable to trapping. It's very applicable to hunting, your business, your life, your job, everything about that. And it's a pretty scary thing once you start asking why. You know, most people ask how. How do I catch a coyote? Why do you want to catch a coyote? So that's a lot bigger story. Or how do I make a dirt hole set? Why do you want to make a dirt hole set? Why do you think that's the best set? When you start asking why, now you're starting to get some things going on in your frontal cortex there that a lot of people on a day-to-day basis don't do. And especially in our information age, you don't really have to know anything. You can just Google something. And then you think that that's all there is to it. And it's not really true, but it gives the illusion that that's wisdom, and it's not, it's information. So we're going to get into all that. But before that, I've got a question that I've saved for about a week. And it's from Chris. And it said, do you know of a fish-based coyote bait? Would your bait solution work well with fish base? Do you sell the bait or solution? Would this be a good change up for heavy action with commercial baits are, and see, let me say that again. Emails are kind of weird to me to read them, especially with my eyes. Would this be good, but be a good change up for heavy action with commercial baits, and or why not? And see, I'm not sure if he's talking about my bait solution or fish. So I'm gonna go about that both directions on here. And it says, thanks for the shows. All of them that are on Trapping Radio. Well, Chris, I appreciate that. Now, I'm trying to think. I do know that there has been some fish-based coyote baits on the market, mostly from very small dealers or from tailgaters and stuff like that, which I'm not putting that down at all. But there has been, and there probably is, I think Blackie, I think his Fatal Attraction could be fish bait or partly fish bait or something like that. A base. Fish is an awesome, you get really good responses from fish when it comes from coyotes. Of course, you know it would coon, even cats, fox, everything else. Now, the tricky part is doing it for yourself and doing it as a business is two different things. And the main reason is fish waters out. And from a lure maker's vernacular, what that means is, like, if you get a 5-gallon bucket of horse meat, you throw the sodium benzoate to it and stuff like that after it's tainted, you're going to have a lot of moisture and stuff that's going to come out of that meat. It's going to settle. Some of it's just going to go away. So you're probably going to have a 10 to 15% loss of liquid from a meat bait if you let it fully taint and you let it sit around for any amount of time. That's just natural. We call it, or at least I do, I call it watering out. Now, fish does it really, really bad. It gets softer and softer over time. Now, there's some things you can do with this, which you can call up Blackie's Blend. Scott owns that now, and he's got a really good resource for zinc value rate, which really helps with the not breaking down of fish when it comes into a coyote bait. But for the most part, if you're doing large volumes of, you know, most of the name brand stuff out there, we've all tried it, but it all turns out to where it works really good. If you make it, you know, right now and you sell it during the convention, it's going to be a little soupy when someone goes to use it in fall. They don't use it all. It's going to be really soupy next spring, and you got an unhappy customer. So from a business point of view, fish is tough. Not that it's not a good base, but it is tough. And you can try, I've tried all different kinds of fish. You know, I've got parts from trout farms, I've tried salmon, depending on if you have the fat in it or not, or you keep the skins or whatever, all of it gives you very different consistencies, which is good. It's fun to play around with, and a lot of those will definitely get different reactions. But you start throwing in ocean fish like menhaden, or, you know, I go down there and I catch a, you know, 190-pound shark or something. Well, that could be turned into bait, but does it do very well? What about octopus? What about squid? You know, what about the saltwater catfish? I mean, you all of these are going to be different, and you're going to get different odors, which get different reactions from everything. But you're always going to have, at least in my experience, the watering out of that bait. Now, saying that, so on a commercial side, probably not that much. On a personal side, if you want to get around and playing with you know, different baits for canines, I would definitely play around with fish. I mean, I definitely would. It's not something you're probably going to like to play around a year after you did it, because it's going to be soupy and it's just not going to look right. And it may smell okay, but it's going to be more difficult, more messy to deal with and stuff like that. But from a personal base, you know, if you wanted to replace beaver meat or tainted bobcat meat or horse meat or mule meat or groundhog meat or whatever meat you're using with the fish, you know, knock yourself out. It's just not something that's going to hold up very well. It's like, you know, you can use liver in baits, which liver is awesome, but if you don't know how to handle the liver, what's going to happen is it's going to water out a lot, And then, you know, if you sold that to somebody, they're not going to be happy because it looks like it's just bloody water in there. It's not. It's the liver. So, I mean, all of these things you have to figure out on your own. And now, you know, I don't mind helping people as far as answering some questions on baits and lures. I'm not going to tell you how to be a lure and bait maker. I mean, I'm just not. That's not going to happen. It's way too involved. I've got way too much time and money and aggravation and epic fails to just, you know, put every bit of that out there. I'm just not going to. That's part of what makes my lures a little bit different than a lot of other lures is all that's went into it. So, but yeah, fish for a base will work. Now the next part of the question, would your bait solution work well with fish? Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind about that. It'd be easy, you know, to do that. And if you want to have a good consistency with fish, like using a bait solution, whether it be mine or somebody else's, you could make it, then freeze it. Once it gets, you know, after about a week or two, once all that goodness gets soaked in there, you can put that in the freezer, have it in smaller batches. So if you know that you're going to probably need, you know, a quart today to go coyote trapping, pull out that quart, then you're going to be dealing with a little bit better consistency than not, and instead of just leaving it in there. You know, when it comes to fish, you've got a lot of weird bacteria you're going to have to deal with, and sometimes you get some strange stuff that happens, which is another reason it's hard to do that more on a commercial basis, because you're dealing with a whole different set of bacteria. Do you sell the bait or solution? I do sell my bait solution through F&T, you know, which is a sponsor here on the show. I have a hard time, to be honest, keeping up with F&T on how much bait solution of mine that's sold. Once people started using it, they keep reordering it. And because of some of the stuff I've got in there, I've been very hesitant to put it on my own store or start wholesaling it out to others, just because I don't know if I'd always have enough, you know, to meet that demand. So I've kind of stuck with just F&T. So if you want my bait solution, you'll have to go to F&T to get it. I don't sell a bait with my bait solution in it. I guess I could, you know, it would be right up there with the rest of mine, you know, Federale's Gator Bait, Primal Paste Bait. It'd be right up there with those as far as quality. There's no doubt about that. But I that's something I don't, you know, I make the bait solution. That's its own product, so that's the reason I go. Now, what I do want to say about this, if you're going to deal with fish, I'm going to tell you a little story. It was comical to me at the time, kind of, just because if you could, I need you to, like, go into meditation mode, breathe in, breathe out, put yourself in southeast Montana with the big rolling sage hills, and all of a sudden you're smelling diesel fume from a great big Super Duty Ford truck, and out of the driver's side steps a 6'7" Craig O'Gorman, absolute coyote killing machine. And I'm in the passenger seat, and we step out into all this gloriness of Montana next to a dried up tank. Not the metal tank, but the actual pond that they have that was dried up. The reason we stopped is Craig saw a dehydrated 8-inch long some type of fish. It had smooth skin on it, so it wasn't like a sucker. It wasn't a catfish. I don't really know what it was. But he saw that out of the truck. He got out and he picked that up. Now keep in mind, Craig's 6'5" or taller, with boots and cowboy hat. He's damn near 7 foot tall. He gets out of that stinking Ford truck and he goes over and sees that fish and he picks it up. When he picks it up, I want you to think of how a mama or someone that the first time a little brother or something holds a baby. You put it in both hands and you kind of cup it together. And you want to make sure that you protect it. And it's always going to be in the best shape possible for as long as it can. That's what Craig did with this dehydrated fish. Now, Montana's a lot different. Here, the fish would have just rotted. out there, it was so hot, so much wind, so little bit of humidity, it just dehydrated. And he had this fish, and he went over to the back of the truck, and he gently set it down in his rot bucket. And when he knew as soon as he saw it, there was a coyote he was having trouble with, and that's what he was going to use for it. Now, that's a fish. Now, you got all of the Powder River Pace baits and all that other stuff he had, but when he saw that fish, it was going to be different. It was not going to rot. It was a fish. Now, he went and he put that in a very deep hole, and he said, if I can catch the coyote and he can't dig it out, then I'm going to use it, and I'll probably cut it up and use it at some flat sets and stuff like that. And that really stuck with me, guys, and I'll tell you why. Because you had all this commercial, I mean, he has, the lure business that he has is massive. And he had all that at his disposal. When he found that dehydrated fish, it really caught his attention. So, if I was going to make a fish bait, would I strictly try to come up with a fish bait if that's what I decide to do? Or would I follow O'Gorman's 6'5", holding the dehydrated fish with both hands cupped like he found a baby in the wilderness? I have a feeling if it was me, I would probably do what Craig was so excited about. And then if I want to play around with mixing different essential oils and fish oils and stuff like that with the fish, I would do that separately, but I would probably do it two ways. I would have the dehydrated, and then I'd have that. Now, there's two ways to handle fish to get pretty much the same thing that Craig had on that fish. Now, one of them is you can salt it, which makes a salty fish that's not going to rot. You don't have to keep them in a freezer or refrigerator. You can keep them for 15 years. It's not going to make any difference. It's not going to smell. It's not going to do anything. You could take all the juice, because if you do this on a big enough scale, you'll have gallons of this fishy saltwater type stuff that you could actually, you know, splatter around the ground to get some excitement going on your coyotes and everything. But it, you know, just take it off, knock the salt off, throw it in the hole. If you want to try the fish, I would probably try that. The other way is, you know, you can go and you can catch some smaller fish like bream. Here you could definitely do shad, you could do menhaden if you're on the coast, or mullet, or whatever it is. The smaller size fish, it's easier to deal with, probably 6 to 8 inches long, and I would dehydrate. Now, you can make solar dehydrators, get online. There's 1.5 million plans on that. You can use, you know, probably a cheap dehydrator to do that. I use, when I dehydrate a lot of my stuff, I use an Excalibur, which is more expensive, but it's kind of like the Cadillac, and it always does exactly what it's supposed to do. If I was going to do that, I would put those fish in that dehydrator till it was dry to the touch and almost where it would break apart, and then I would stick them in probably in something like newspaper, and I would stack them up in a sealable bag or in a food saver tape bag. And then when I would go out trapping, I'd grab a bag or, you know, partial of a bag or whatever, and then I would mix that up, because variety is the spice of life when it comes to coyotes. So just keep that in mind, you know, when you're doing it. Then see how your coyotes do it. Listen to your trap line tell you if it's a good deal or not. You know, but I will warn you, when you start experimenting, especially if you don't have a lot of experience making lures and baits, you're going to have a lot that's going to be absolute failures. Now, if you're relying on that fur for money or for a certain catch number or something like that, you're taking a huge risk. But that's totally up to you if you want to take that. But I'm just letting you know that, because I made a lot of stuff I thought was going to be very good, and it sucked. And that's part of the reason you don't see me coming out with new lures every 24 hours like a lot of people do. There's no way those are tested. I'm just going to say that openly. No way those are tested. It takes a while to come up with something, at least to me, that I'm going to put my name associated with. So, and when you're doing it with the lack of experience a lot of times, just because you heard someone say this is good or that's good or whatever, just keep in mind that you're going to start going through more of a scientific study type thing trying to figure this out than you are an actual probably big time production, which is not a bad thing because, you know, learning, you know how I feel about learning, but it may hurt your catch. That's my only thing. But I will probably say adding some dehydrated or salted fish in on a cow line probably not going to hurt anything. I don't think I would go out and try to, you know, break any records with it, but I definitely don't think it's going to hurt anything. So, you know, it's an interesting question. That's something that almost everybody thinks about at one time or another. You know, you go out and catch fish. You got these heads. You catch more than you want to eat. It's fish you may not want to eat. You have this stuff. You know, is there a way to put it to use, which is an awesome way of thinking. So yeah, put it to use somehow or another. You know, figure out something to use for it. I grow tomatoes with all my fish heads. So I mean, I don't waste stuff like that. But just keep that in mind when you're doing it. Now, we're going to get on to, and I'm going to try something that hopefully doesn't backfire too bad, is I'm going to try a little bit of reading. And probably not the most legal thing to do. But when I was in bed last night, after I did the rant of the trapper, after I talked to Travis, after Chip texted me and actually had two more emails saying how much they liked that rant, I happened to start this book, and within the first 10 pages, it was like lined up with the, you know, if you believe in karma, karma was doing it. If you believe in fate, fate was doing it. I mean, it lined up perfectly. So I'm thinking about doing that. But before I do, let's think a little bit about our trapping or anything else that we deal with. You have a how and you have a why. The how is like a technique. A why is not a technique. The how can be very specific. You make a dirt hole. So you're going to decide to do a Charlie Robbins dirt hole set. You need to have a hole that's 6 to 8 inches round, as deep as you can get it. The bed's on an angle to drain the water, yada, 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 all the things. That is the how. The more difficult and different question is why. Why would I want to do a Charlie Robbins dirt hole set? Why do I want to do that here? Why do I want to do it at this time of the year? You know, those whys are what separate the hows. And most of the people that just rely on how, they fall short of their full potential because they don't know the whys. And the why is a much bigger question. I see this all the time, and it doesn't matter what the subject is. Someone will call up, how do I catch a bobcat eating my chickens? All they want to know is you do this, 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 and this, and there'll be a bobcat standing in front of you the next day. They don't care about why any of it works the way that it does, or why they should put it where they should put it, or if that even matters, or, well, if he says bait, I ain't buying bait, I'll just get a can of sardines or marshmallows or whatever. They don't ask the why maybe a certain lure is what you need to use over just sardines or something like that. But the how and why is very different. The why is the most important thing that you can grapple with. And that's what you're going to do. You're going to grapple. If you start asking why, like a kid, you know, kids are much smarter than adults when it comes to a lot of different things. If you know, I've been around, I don't have children, but I've been around enough of them to know they ask why about everything. They're curious. They want to know. They're kind of searching. It may not be that big a deal to them, but they're searching. So they're asking for why. Why is the sky blue? Why are plants green? Why? And what do adults do? They kind of answer them, get them off the subject. Why do you keep asking why? You know, I'm busy, yada, yada, yada. Same thing that happened to you when you were in school. Now that we're adults, we're busy. There's no time for why. So we worry about the how. And we miss the biggest part of anything that's really important. Why do we use money? Why, for goodness sake, does the federal government borrow money from the Federal Reserve and have to pay it back when by the Constitution they can print it themselves and there would be no debt associated with that money? Now, You start grappling with that, that's going to lead you in all different kind of places. That's a very simple question to me. Why do we borrow money from the Fed? I know why the Fed wants it, the Federal Reserve, is because they're making money off of something they're making up out of thin air. But why are politicians doing it? See, now you're starting to go down a bigger stretch. You know, instead of how to trap, why do you trap? Why? Specifically, have you ever even asked your, I love it, that's not a why answer. What do you specifically love? And then once you understand the why, are you feeding the why that gets you to do what you get joy from, like trapping? Or do you end up doing things because of the how that takes the fun and the joy out of why you started trapping in the first place? See, these are pretty deep questions. And everybody's going to have a different why. They may all have the same how, but there's going to be a different why of why they trap. Why do you hunt? Why do I feel it's important to grow a lot of my own food? You know, I think about such things. And then I always want to make sure the how doesn't get in the way of the why. But for a lot of folks, that's not the way that it is. You know, when you're thinking about trapping, why are you using the traps that you're using? Not just because so-and-so said they're good traps, but why are you using them? Why are you using the same trap at a dirt hole as you do a flat set? You ever wondered? Maybe you should. I'm not saying there's a difference, but why? I can tell you there is a difference in me setting long springs and coil springs when it comes to blind sets. There's a definite why. I use coil springs more in blind sets than I do long springs. There's a reason for that. I had to work out the why so the how didn't get in the way. Why do you use the sets you use? Most people, how do you catch a coyote? You put in a dirt hole. How do you make a dirt hole? Really? Okay, I can do this. Now see, if you want to start learning to be a better trapper, why do I want to put in a dirt hole? If you were to ask most trappers that, you would get a short answer that really doesn't say anything at all about why they're doing it. It's going to be a self-defense mechanism. I know it will be, because they've never thought of why either. Because it's all about the how. You know, why do you use the lures and baits that you use? Why do you use them in the months that you use them? Why do you use them if it's, dispersal for coyotes? And why would you use the same thing during springtime when you don't have dispersal? Why? Not how do you put lure, or where do you put lure, or how much lure, but why? That's a lot different. Let me see here. I've got a few notes here before I get to what I was doing, and I just got lost. Have you ever really asked a question of why you put a trap? See, this is a big one to me. This is why it gets kind of sideways a lot of times when I try to give a demo. Why do you set a trap? Where you set it the same way no matter what's going on around you? Why? See, how you make a set. So someone tells you to make a set, you dig a hole, you come back 10 inches pan center, offset left or right, move it over at an angle, you know, you go off the whatever, you know, degrees of this or that or the other, and that's how you make the sets. Okay, I know how, but why? And if someone just goes, well, that's where they put their feet, you're not talking to anybody that knows why. They're just justifying whatever it is that they're doing. So why do you put your trap where you put it at a set? Why is it the same no matter if the ground is sloped, if it's closer or further away from a road or a travel way? Why is it the same place if it's in an open field or a grown-up field? Why is it the same whether it's in the woods or on a swamp levee somewhere? Why is it the same? Now, you want to start becoming a better trapper? Start figuring out that why. That's why when I do the demos, it's hard when someone goes, well, where do you put your trap? Well, that depends on where the set's at. Okay, well, where are you going to put the set at? Well, that depends on, you know, this, this, and this. Because it's always about the why. It's not about the how. Where the trap physically goes is irrelevant without the why. Or it's just a technique that's going to get you somewhere with a little bit of success because you're running off averages like running in a casino or something. So why? Why is it important? Have you ever asked yourself that? You know, why do you go to work and work the way that you do? Why don't you go to work and work a different way than you do? Why do you have the truck that you have? Why do you go out and you go fishing? Why do you think it's important to eat the fish or not to eat the fish that you catch? Why are you short-tempered with people on a daily basis? Why do you go out of your way to help your neighbor? Why? That to me, that's a lot bigger type thing. Now see, the why leads you down an area that most people don't want to put the time in, to be honest with you, to try to figure out. And here's the reason why. Hows are like roadmaps. How do you make a set? How do you make more money? How do you wash your clothes? I mean, it doesn't matter. But it's like a roadmap. It's like a formulaic type thing that as long as nothing ever changes, you're okay. Which is, to me, what's so scary about young kids today. They're not allowed to ask why. They're not allowed to look into these type questions. School is nothing but about passing tests. It has nothing to do with education. You've got all of these young people coming up that learned how to pass a test, and they don't even know what it was about 2 months from then. And it's a roadmap. The teacher says you study this, and eventually you get to the grade that you want to get. They're not allowed to go out and play with a bunch of other kids that's not supervised, where you have specific rules and specific places and the roadmap's not laid out for them the way that we used to as a kid. We would just take off. We would find people. We would make up games. We'd figure out the rules. We'd bloody some noses, break some limbs. We'd fall off of stuff sometimes. We learned how to do things without a roadmap, but that's not the way that it is now. Everybody now wants a roadmap. Well, how do you make a permaculture farm? Well, that's the craziest question in the world to me. You know, how do you go out and catch 100 coyotes? Well, that's a crazy question to me. You know, so the crossroads of a map is where most people falter. So you've got a map. Say you've got GPS. You're using a Garmin. I think that's what I have. So I'm going down to a trapping convention somewhere and I'm not paying attention where I'm at because that little box is supposedly knows where I'm at and where I'm going. And all of a sudden I realize for whatever reason that I'm not going in the right direction or it quits working. Now see, I'm at a crossroads. That's what happens with people that don't ask why and they're only looking for the hows, which is the roadmap. All of a sudden now you've got a crossroad. You've got to turn left or right, but see, that wasn't on the map. That wasn't in the list of hows. You're going to have to make a judgment call based on a trip that you hadn't been paying attention to because your Garmin failed, and now you got to choose left or right. And once you're out in the middle of, in a different place and you don't have anything that you can really figure out where you're at, you're just kind of screwed because you don't know. Now, when you have a why, whys are kind of like, I've heard this put in the past, when you really understand your why, it's like a compass heading. North is always north, south is always south. So you kind of have a heading, but you don't have a roadmap. But as long as you follow that, the heading of going south, if you're going south or going north, no matter what you come across, I got to keep going south or north. But if you have a roadmap and you don't have a heading, all of a sudden now you're totally reliant on someone else's roadmap for you, and it doesn't work very well. At least I don't think it does. Because that's why people do a lot of things they don't want to do you know, until they're old and they retire, and then they're too broke down to do what they really wish they should have done all those years ago, because they follow roadmaps of people that don't even know what your why is. How can they give you this roadmap? You know, so the hows are the map, and without the why or the compass heading, you're going to get off kilter. Now, what I'm getting ready to try to do, and I'm not the best person to read into a recorder, and I'll admit that, but there's no way, and this is from the book Extreme Early Retirement. I actually heard this from a guy named Paul Wheaton on a podcast, and he said it changed his life years and years ago. So Mr. Wheaton seems like he's a pretty intelligent guy, so I ordered the book up and I started reading it. So I don't even know if the book's any good past this point or not. Up to this point, it's pretty thought-provoking, I'll give you that. But I want to read, because he's going to use an allegory here of the why, basically, of someone in retirement. Now, if you get caught up in the retirement part and the money part of this, keep it on track with trapping, because you're going to start seeing similarities also in your money, also in business and everything else. Now, it's an allegory about Plato's cave, and that's, you know, that's a classic. I mean, if you've never read it, you probably should, because there's a lot, I mean, a lot of stuff in that can open your eyes. But I want to read this just because I probably couldn't put it in as good of words as he does. And it's pretty earth-shattering if you're always about the how and not the why. There are a few allegories that explain this progression in thinking. The oldest is Plato's cave. In Plato's cave, prisoners have been arranged in a row in a dark cave since childhood. They're chained, so they can't move their bodies. And their heads are restrained, so they can only face forward towards a wall. They can hear and speak, but they can't see each other, nor can they see themselves. Behind them is a fire. The fire's light shows the shadows of the prisoners on the wall. Between the prisoner the fire, there are people and animals acting out realistic playcasting shadows on the wall as well. The prisoners see only the shadows, but they hear all of the sounds. Naturally, they think the world is composed of shadows on the wall, that they themselves are shadows on the wall. And I'm going to stop from what he's saying. Basically, what's going on is you've got a bunch of kids, and this is a story now. It's a teacher lesson. You got a bunch of kids in a cave that's never seen themselves or another human being. They're chained. They can't look around. So their whole perspective on the world is the only thing they can see is a shadow on the wall, because behind them is the light. In front of them is darkness, and they can see the fire behind them on the wall. So that's what he's referring to. The shadows talk to each other and interact. It all makes sense to the prisoners, who think that all the shadows on the wall are like themselves. The prisoners even know each other through the shadows they see and the voices they hear. They gain status by their ability to recognize other shadows and predict what they'll do. Now imagine that one of the prisoners is released. Now keep in mind, guys, this is all these prisoners have ever known since birth. His shackles fall to the ground and he can turn his head. He sees the other prisoner sitting in a row, chained to the ground, and he's horrified. He also sees the actors and animals between the prisoners and the fire. He sees the cave opening and ventures out. He is blinded by the light, but finally sees the big picture. All his life he has been sitting in a cave, chained to the ground, believing that the wall was it. Now he has realized that the action on the wall is guiding mainly by a few actors, with the prisoners providing commentary. Now he sees the opportunities in the real world. He feels duty-bound to go back and inform the prisoners of the situation and try to release them. First, he tries to explain the existence of the puppet masters to the prisoners, but the masters are unlikely to cooperate since they derive much personal benefit from the current way of the world. Then he tries to explain how the system is arranged with the prisoners and the cave. Tragically, he finds prisoners are more resistant than he expected. Most don't believe him. And why should they? Having adjusted to the light outside, He can't see the shadows as clearly as they can. What a dimwit. Taking off the chains requires too much effort. So most of them remain seated. These are people who are very good and successful at identifying, naming, and dealing with shadows, so they may not want to leave. And this happens every day, guys, in the real world. There are also those who do feel the need to leave. Leaving is not easy. It requires much learning, reorientation, one's values from success with identifying shadows, equating success with moving around in the real world. In real life, the prisoners of Plato's Caves are those who are prisoners, are slaves to their own wages and their culture. The wage slave, now don't get caught up on the wage slave thing here. Think about this in terms of trapping too. A wage slave is a wage earner who is entirely dependent on their wages. While the wage slave is free to leave the current job, he isn't free to leave the job market altogether, and he can likely not imagine the possibility of doing so. He is still entirely focused on the wall. The wall shows other people, not as who they are, but as what they own. There goes a man in his new sports car. What is not seen is the car is bought on credit, and the man is stressed because he is having trouble making the payments. Wage slaves have jobs where they can go and spend most of their productive hours writing high-powered memos so they can be more productive, while other people spend their time ignoring memos so they can be more productive too. This is how it goes. In fact, one of the greatest inventions of the 20th century, the personal computer, have made it possible to write even more memos and notices. This is great because it allows people to do their job while looking busier than ever. Looking busy is important because this is the culture of business, and that is a virtue. Just as being in debt is a virtue, and the most virtuous are those with the highest credit card scores, they're better at being in debt compared to other people. This endless working and paying is called making a living. Yet people are so busy making a living that they have no time for living. A wage slave is a person that is not only economically bound by mortgages, loans, and other obligations, but also mentally bound by the inability to perceive that there are other options available, like the prisoners in Plato's cave. Their chains are not physical like those of 150 years ago, though they are still in some parts of the world. The chains are mental, which in some sense makes them worse because it turns the prisoners into their own prison wardens, like the slaves in Plato's cave. The only commonly accepted way for them to leave is to win the prison game, which means accumulating at least $1 million to retire. The disenchanted grumble about the system or the man. The analogy of the system is the people walking around behind the chain slaves, keeping them going. However, it's mainly the slaves themselves who keep themselves going. We don't realize that we maintain this system by lack of imagination and questioning. Like birds which never have a flight plan, yet always seem to fly together in a swarming flock. We don't question, we obediently pick whatever options are handed to us, often choosing based on what our neighbors have chosen. We make the best of the shadows on the wall, but we do not question the wall. The best prison is the one with the invisible bars. Perhaps one reason for this complacency is a large quantity of material goods available to the chain gang. Material goods are often used as compensation. Frequently, when someone is depressed, the advice is to go out and spend some money, buy yourself something. Treat yourself. Try a little retail therapy. People don't seem to realize that this attempt to feel good is exactly what propagates the problem. Compared to people just 50 years ago, modern wage slaves live a life of material abundance. They're consumers. They have big screen TVs, movies on demand, microwave ovens, food processors, 24-piece flatware. They own multiple pairs of shoes, enough clothes for more than a week without doing laundry. They have carpeted floor, matching furniture, vacuum cleaners. They have expensive toys. That they have car payments, college degree, five-bedroom, three-bathroom mortgages, laptop computers, cell phones, contracts, power tools, and 108-piece bit drill sets, premium cable, air conditioning system, blenders, food processors, pool tables, DVD players, granite countertops. They redecorate, attend sporting events, go on vacation, and occasionally play with their toys. Society has made it very easy to spend money. Shopping centers line every street. Many creative means of spending money have been devised. Instead of spending 30 seconds opening a can of tomatoes with a traditional can opener, it's now possible to spend 30 minutes working to pay for an electric can opener that can open a can in the same amount of time. Many ways we used to do things have been redesigned to ensure that instead of doing it ourselves, we can buy some gadget or some service and have it done for us. This is convenient because we're usually too busy working to pay for it to do it ourselves. This is a gist of the service economy. Presumably, if we didn't create enough problems to spend time solving them, the economy would collapse. To speed up consumption, it's possible to obtain loans, spend money that's yet to be earned. All is required to promise of increased amount of work in the future and a commitment for up to 30 years to pay the money back twice the amount in interest. Lots of personal finance gurus are willing to charge you money to advise you as to exactly how to distribute your money to retirement plans, college saving plans, mortgages, credit cards, etc. to maximize your lifetime consumption. Success and power are equaled with spending money. It usually starts with toys for the children and quickly evolves to cell phones, fashionable clothes. Many realize that demonstrating their personal value through their color or the build of their cell phone is perhaps inadequate, and then move on to bigger and more expensive propositions like large cars, redecorating, or kitchen renovation. Not that there's anything wrong with such creative outlets, but the scale of these projects is often mind-boggling, with tens of thousands being spent on marginal increases in functionality. The old but typically fully functional items are discarded, especially if they have those ugly 1970 earth tones or that bland 1980 beige or whatever we had in the 90s. Try for a moment to envision the large pile of abandoned yet functional telephones, TVs, furniture, toys, old clothes, shoes, LPs, CDs, packing material you have discarded your whole life. Such stuff doesn't magically disappear. It goes somewhere, typically a landfill. Now multiply that by several hundred million people. Not cool. If the main vein, tally up the sum total of your earned income so far, subtract your savings, and compare the difference to your pile of stuff. Was it really a good deal? Is spending the most productive years of your life chained to a job market to collect a lot of rarely used stuff that gathers dust in the closet or takes up space in the junkyard? Is this a wise choice? Were you really born just to die, leaving a large pile of discarded consumer goods? Probably not. I realize that not wanting a house full of things makes me look weird and recently unpatriotic. This is back after 9/11. After all, more is better, and who doesn't want to be better? But perhaps conformity is not only the way to live. In fact, by taking the other end of the bargain, saving as much as other people are spending on wants, it's possible to retire and live on invested savings after just 5 years of full-time work. Rather than increasing the amount of work to require some stuff, reducing the superficial need reduces the amount of necessary work. It's possible to reduce the amount of work all the way down to zero, financial independence. Indeed, playing the shadow game for 5 years provides a permanent way out of the cave. Alternatively, it's also possible to return to the cave for a few months every year to earn money for the next adventure out of the cave. This is living on the economy, so to speak, rather than living in the economy. The resulting freedom can be spent on personal projects such as reading books, visiting places, entertaining. It can also be used to start businesses, engage in a second career, or to care for family members, etc., without worrying about having to support oneself. This book explains, but it is really becomes quite simple once you realize the option is there. I have done it, and many others have too. In my financial independence, this has provided a greater sense of balance to ones compared to doing just one thing. In addition, it doesn't postpone this balance until traditional retirement age. So that's pretty big to me. When people who have been stuck in the same place all their life decide that they need to travel, only to find out that they're sick of traveling after a while because they never figured out exactly what makes them happy. The most frequent objection to casting off the chains is that living on something corresponding to every third paycheck or every fourth paycheck, as opposed to a living paycheck, must be a boring life. Not knowing any better, I must admit that I started my own venture with such assumptions, but back then the knowledge and the wisdom relevant to such an undertaking wasn't easy to come by. I had to discover everything from scratch. I grew up as a consumer, and I spent my money on increasingly larger toys. I knew a ton about various CPUs and how to match memory and graphic cards to build the ultimate gaming machine. I also had pretty good high hand-eye coordination for many hours playing computer games like most consumers. I was wholly ignorant of ways to attain a high-quality life without spending money. This is why retirement saving goals are frequently in the millions. Those, and there are majority, who have to pay for every convenience really need that much. I messed that up. I'm gonna go and stop. Like I said, I'm not the best. But if that was flowing enough for you to understand what that was doing, he was asking a why in a very interesting way. Why do we have to work 40 hours a week? Why do you need a full-time job? Why do you need to buy everything because you're so busy living a life to pay for everything? I mean, you're talking about the gerbil on the wheel thing, you know, and the silent change that people have is because they chain themselves to this ideology and they never ask why. Now, when it comes to trapping, most trappers never ask why either. Because once you start asking that why, you'll find out that a lot of folks rather be chained to the floor in the cave looking at the shadows because that's all they know and anything else kind of scares them. You have these questions, and I hear that all the time. But what if, what if, what if, you know, if you start your own business, well, what if this happens and what if that happens? And someone wants a roadmap from the time they're going to start their business to they retire given to them in complete detail where there's no variation and all they have to do is follow this map and bam, they're dead and everything worked out perfect. Or they're going to keep doing what they've always done, which is for a lot of Americans, pretty much a sucky life. Now, when it comes to trapping, it ain't really a whole lot different. Most people don't take out-of-state trips and go experience the full glory of going on a trap line because of what ifs. Because, and that's that. I mean, that is an email I get all the time. Where do you stay? What do you do with your food? How much clothes do you take? How many traps do you need? How much lure do you need? All this. And I can go on and on and on. Because people have been trained, because they never asked why, that they want somebody that's done this to give them a complete roadmap with every little minute detail that's not even going to work for them because we're different. Our goals are different. Our whys are different. Everything's different. But they never do it because what if? And on the rant yesterday, when I was talking about you have to choose, and every situation you find yourself into, most of the time you're there exactly because you choose. People choose to always struggle with money. They don't do that openly where they consciously think about it, but their decisions are. It's very different the way that someone that makes a lot of money and keeps a lot of money and does a lot of different things, they look at money very differently. They choose to. You know, there was a show, it was on HBO, The Rock was on it, and he was trying to be agents of other sports people, because he's in the show, he got hurt and he wasn't playing anymore, whatever. And one of the things in there that really, he said it two or three times in the show to different football players that had all this money, is they'd come up in their new Ferrari. And he goes, "You buying that or leasing that?" And most of them would go, "Well, I bought that." And he goes, "Son, that's stupid. You always lease what depreciates and you buy what appreciates." Now, see, that is a choice that a lot of people don't make in their everyday lives when it comes to whatever it is. Someone that chooses to look at money in a productive, long-term way, they look at depreciating assets, which is like the kingpin of people that don't make a lot of money, because all they want is the fanciest clothes. You can go to any hood in America and there's people wearing tennis shoes I can't afford. That makes no sense to me. Or there's somebody that's renting a roach filled apartment somewhere as cheap as they can. Like they got a $45,000 Chevrolet truck or Corvette or something out in the front driveway. See, they've chosen to go with the depreciating asset instead of the asset that's going to grow over time. That's a choice they're making. I'm just using these as an example because I think we can kind of grasp that. You know, you put money in a gun, it's not going to depreciate very much. It's probably going to appreciate. You put money in the newest Nike basketball, let you jump an extra, you know, 0.3 inches in a basketball game. Once you buy them, that depreciates. But that's what a lot of people do. And I'm going to give you the difference on choice and thinking about your whys in a real trapping story. Now, most of y'all are going to know who one of these are, but I'm not going to mention his name. And a lot of y'all are going to know the other guy if I were to mention his name. But I'm not going to, because it's not my place to. But this is an honest-to-goodness, true story about two trappers. One chose one direction. One chose the other direction. The whys were very different in life for one to the other. Now, one of these was a trapper. Pretty well-known trapper. A lot of things happened to him. Anyway, he hooked up with this other trapper. And this other trapper was buying fur. And this was back during the original fur boom in the, you know, 70s going into the 80s. And they both knew each other. They both trusted each other. They're both great people. So they kind of partnered up. Well, the trapper that's done a lot more trapping, he would go out and buy fur and get a percentage. Now, every time during that time, you'd go buy a coon for $15. By the time you brought it back to the building, it's worth $17. You know, I mean, it was crazy the amount of money that was changing hands. Now, one was fronting the money, one was fronting the labor and spending all the time to go do this. This went on for year after year after year. So we're going to say the first trapper that I mentioned is Trapper A, that did probably more trapping than Trapping B. The one that funded the money was Trapper B. Now, Trapper A, when I asked him one time about this, and we were by ourselves, and you know there wasn't an ego blustering thing going on, just kind of curious, what did he do? He bought three-wheelers. And yeah, if you're young, that's what they used to be, three-wheelers, and they were pretty much on, you're going to go to the hospital on one. Let's just say that. Little John boats, a bunch of used traps, a bunch of guns that he ended up selling later, stuff like that. He chose because his wildlife was very different. He burnt through all of that money. Now, Trapper B bought farmland. he bought apartments. So when you, I want you to realize the type of money I'm talking about. Bought apartment buildings, bought farms, bought rental houses. Trapper A bought toys. Trapper B bought stuff that increases in value and makes money. That's a true story. One is very well off today, and the other one is really not. For the most part, I would say nothing like the other one. They both had the same opportunity. It was the same splitting of the same money for the same product, everything like that. One has ended up selling three-wheelers for pennies on the dollar, and one was buying apartment buildings that he's still making money on today. Their whys are different, and they chose differently. They both had the same opportunity. They went different directions. I find that interesting because Trapper A is crazy intelligent, off the charts intelligent, but his why was different. Trapper B, I don't think, on an IQ test, may not be the same as Trapper A, may not be as high, because Trapper A was crazy creative and intelligent. Trapper B was intelligent and smart, and especially the way he handled his money at the time from trapping. Two totally different outcomes. You know, you may think this has nothing to do with trapping, but I promise you it does. Because it's about life and trapping. If you're a trapper like most of us, that is a huge percentage of your life. It's the difference between struggling and not struggling. Having different revenue streams or not having different revenue streams. More importantly, it's about having chains that you put on yourself on a daily basis. You keep the chains on there. You make decisions based off of all this garbage that's being propagandized to us on a daily basis since we were kids. And some of you are not going to have chains. Now, the ones that don't have chains now, congratulations, brother. And the ones that do have chains, start thinking at the world in a little bit different way. I promise you it's a lot different than you think it is. Once you realize that the shadows on that cave wall are not really real. The happiness that comes from watching the shadows is not really real. You can get up and change your life whenever you choose to. You can choose to be the monster trapper or the not monster trapper. Totally up to you. You can choose to be a how trapper where you really don't know why and it doesn't seem to really work out the way you want it. Or you can choose to be a why trapper, and then once you start asking those questions, things get a little bit different in your trapping world. Totally up to you. Just something to think about, guys.
Outside, well, if you think you're man enough, you really wanna knuckle up. If you won't outside. Let's take it outside. These days things have changed. A lot of talk, a lot of push and shove. Well, if you won't walk the walk, well, let's have some respect. I got girls in here. Just pay your tab, lay down your beer halls, and let's take it outside. Well, if you think you're man enough, you really wanna knuckle up. If you wanna shed a little blood, then let's take it outside. Let's take it outside. Let's take it outside. Let's take it outside, yeah.